Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Mengistu, for the kind introduction. Thank you to APHA to give us the possibility of this conjoint session. My task today will be to introduce you to the reasons why the World Federation thought it would be their task to think about public health in today's global setting. I'm going to do so with some thoughts I would like to have together with you. I have no conflict of interest, besides being a female, that's already one, and so forth. As our Vice President and President-elect said so nicely, the World Federation of Public Health is the only worldwide professional society representing and serving the broad field of public health. And our mission is to promote and protect global health. So, we, and if not we, would ask the question, how is public health viewed and lived in today's global setting? I think we have to do it. We are almost the ones who have to do it. But before I start with public health, allow me to take you to the history of art and have two British or English historians of art cited. One is Kenneth Clark, who did a very nice book about civilization. It also was a TV series in all later days. When asked the question, what is civilization, he said, I don't know. I can't define it in abstract terms yet. But I think I can recognize it when I see it. If you ask people about public health, I think they would answer the other way around. I can recognize when public health is not there. This photograph was taken by Letitia Bukam, our co-worker, when she visited Kathmandu earlier this year. I think we all could see some details who explain us that a lot of public health items are not or are missing here. Another historian of art, a little bit earlier than Kenneth Clark, has said that great nations write their biographies in three manuscripts: the book of their deeds, the book of their words, and the book of their art. Not one of these books can be understood unless we read the two others. But of the three, the only trustworthy is the last. Well, he is an historian of art, so for sure for him this is the one. I think today we should say that the book of health of populations is almost as important. As already mentioned by Mengistu, we all know the classical definitions of public health. The Winslow one, public health is a science and art of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting health throughout the organized efforts of society. This definition is intentionally generic. It puts public health as knowledge and action, prevent disease, promote health, and it says that public health is an organized societal function. You know that there are a lot other definitions. There is one from the WHO headquarters. There are regional WHO ones. There is one from APHA. Several academic and non-institutions did do definitions. But we know that defining public health is a contested area, and we could recognize three different types of definitions of public health according to main axes, to the extent to which they either frame public health functions and then public health workforce, we will go to this with Ehud Myron's talk, or they are normative and descriptive, or they incorporate wider social determinants and environmental factors and health inequalities. But the question is whether the current available definitions of public health fully capture the current public health challenges and the current societal changes. What are the challenges? The challenges we all know are the industrialization, the technology impact on the ecological systems for future generations. We know that there is a lack of work for future conditions of health. Instead, we are mainly concerned with immediate risk and short-term benefits. Our scientific evidence base is ill-suited for a lot of questions. RCTs will not identify the results for complex interventions, so we will not have the scientific evidence we need. The challenges also are that equity, human rights, and political empowerment have to be integrated. Very importantly also, we have to see the intergenerational equity now, because never before we lived with four generations in life in a lot of countries. We have to look at the transnational global aspects of health. We have to integrate the complexity and the non-linearity of public health problems. And we need new approaches that understand all these linkages and relationships and interactions. We know that a lot of people are working and are already doing, especially around the post-2015 agenda, like the UN, the world we want. A lot of things are going on, and people try to define common priorities for collective action. Not to mention that our political world has changed, and that we see nowadays and still end of autocracies, not only the Soviet system, but also if we think of North Africa and countries around, the end of hierarchical patronage machines. We are now in a possibility of having a worldwide conversation that hasn't been the case before. Another perhaps challenge might be to look at the old, let's see, binome, healthcare and public health. Healthcare systems are clear and familiar to most people, visible, valued, and they identify and repair already existing health problems that have been arisen from past exposure. The schematic view that's all familiar to you between a public health system and a health care system, see here, you see that only a part of the health is really influenced by the healthcare system on the top of the scheme. It could be a challenge, another challenge, to see if clinical medicine and public health, if there are possibilities to align clinical medicine, especially primary care, with community health. And are there possibilities to change professional culture between clinical medicine and public health? We know that there is a long history of professional autonomy. Can we perhaps bridge the cultures of medicine and public health as a challenge? Let me go back to Ruskin, whom I cited at the very beginning. He said that these great nations write their books in three chapters. I think that a society's approach to health is a statement reflecting the value it places on health as a fundamental right, and that's how we will now value nations. These are the reasons that the World Federation took up, together with the World Health Organization, in their recent collaboration plan, a work on public health in today's global setting. We started in May with a lunchtime seminar at WHO on the topic. We are now in an internal consultation process. We hope to get a think tank together beginning of next year, and we hope to have a side event on the topic at the next World Health Assembly in 2015 in Geneva. And during 2015, the work will be processing using social media also of the WHO and get as much input as possible. And the deadline where we have to have finished our work will be February 2015, where we want to present our work at the Calcutta meeting. What is the methodology? First of all, we involve directors of National Public Health Institute to give their input. We are then going to run a Delphi study with selected public health specialists and experts nicely distributed all over the world. As usually in a Delphi, we are then consolidating the results. We also want to have input from the political world, and then we refine and build consensus. Well, in this complex world, what are the possible ways out? For sure, help could come from system science, could come from systems philosophy, surely from avoiding the silo thinking, We know that in this work we will integrate all the regional members of the World Federation and get it clearly that there is a global interconnectivity in the picture. We are all in one boat, and there is no such thing as to be sure glad that the whole is on our end. We know that. I come back to my field of art history. I think there are some parallels between civilization and public health. They have common enemies. Enemies of public health as well as civilization are fear, the fear of war, intrusion, diseases, famine. The fear also to don't dare question anything or change anything. And in public health, as in civilization, it requires confidence in societies, its laws, its philosophy, a lot of vigor, energy, and vitality. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Bettina, for having a better discussion. We will hear all the presentations, and we'll have a question and answer session by the end of the all four presentations. The next one will be by Professor Gabriel Scali. Gabriel is a professor at the University of West of England, Bristol, UK, a highly respected public health physician with wide leadership experience both in the UK and internationally. He has extensive experience both within the national health system and the Department of Health. Gabriel is a member of the Governing Council of the World Federation of Public Health Association. And using examples drawn from reorganization of the public health in England, his presentation will frame some directions for future public health thinking, research, and action. Gabriel.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're here to talk about the new public health, and I think this is probably the third new public health I've been through in my career so far, and I wondered about how many there'd been, and I did a search, and I found them popping up all over the places. The first one being, I think, at the States, where there was a new public health around the a very famous book around the 1920s, I think, about the new public health. And I don't believe that there is any such thing as the new public health at all. I believe what we're doing is we're practicing the same public health, but we're practicing it under different circumstances, under circumstances that are changing around us. And at times they change very fast, and I believe fundamentally that we are in such a time now. There was a German philosopher who once said, men make their men and women, he should have said, I presume, make their own history, but they don't necessarily make it under circumstances of their own choosing. And we're not practicing our public health under circumstances of our own choosing. We're practicing it under a set of circumstances that are made for us by others, by other individuals, but by governments, by civic organizations, and importantly, I think now, by multinational corporations and particularly by the finance sector. So I don't believe that there is a new public health, but we do need new methods and new tactics and new approaches to enable us to carry out our mission, which is to improve the health of the population. And one of the key elements for my practice of public health, where I practice it in England, in the UK, is that we've got to learn about austerity and learn what it means to practice public health at a time of austerity. And what austerity means for us is quite significant. I'll come on to that. I think the second great new set of circumstances that confronts us and needs us to alter and move our practice is around climate change and the effects of climate change, but also the causation of climate change and our disregard to issues around ecology and the planet on which we live. And in fact, I was walking over to this meeting with some colleagues, and we were talking about various things, and I'm a great fan of the WHO definition of health, state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. There was a very fine English general practitioner and epidemiologist who wrote a book called Common Diseases. John Fry was his name. He's long dead now. But in his first chapter, he talked about the various definitions of health. And he talked about a utopian definition, and he used those words from the preamble, the 1946 preamble to the WHO Constitution, to illustrate that. And he said he thought that it was indeed a utopian definition, and was only ever likely to be achieved during sexual intercourse. And I said that at a meeting once, and there was a voice from the back, a woman's voice, who said, "And sometimes not even then." But I think perhaps this definition could do with being slightly updated, and we maybe should think very seriously about changing that definition to be in a complete state of physical, mental, social, and ecological health. And that time, I think, has come when we need to regard our response to climate change and to the well-being of our planet absolutely alongside the rest of our public health concerns. The next one, I think, that challenges us in the future is urbanisation. We've very recently passed the stage in the world where 50% of the population is now urbanised. We're heading very rapidly. I think it's by 2050. The prediction, current UN prediction, is something around 84% of the population of the world will be urbanised. And I know in Europe it'll be even higher. So urbanisation is such a phenomenon, and it's going to change the nature of our lives and the nature of our population life so much in every continent of the world. And I think the other thing that's changing, and which I'll talk a bit more, is the role of the state and the way in which, in very many countries, the role of the state, the role of us doing collectively in civil society organisations or political organisations, is under attack. And where individualism is being inserted into a space where collective efforts and collective organisation has certainly existed for all of my life. And in fact, I've been a beneficiary of much of that collective action, whether it be in terms of education or health or whatever. So I think those are the new circumstances under which we have to practice our public health, but practice it in new ways. And I use... As Mengistu said, I want to use the example of the NHS because it's very interesting. We had a very interesting meeting earlier this morning talking about the way in which the health system in the US with the Affordable Health Care Act is coming in one direction. We in the NHS under a very much more right-wing government than you are heading in the opposite direction with the dismantling of the National Health Service. And that is happening at some pace, but it is accompanied by an austerity that runs across the whole of our society, so that every element of what has been built painstakingly since the Second World War in terms of a welfare state is under attack, for example. Free education. I was a beneficiary of free education. 1948 Education Act, I attended medical school for 6 years, as it was then. Never paid any fees. And in fact received a grant, even though my father was a doctor, received a grant all the way through my time at medical school. That has changed. And that was that was put in place by a government in the UK in the aftermath of the Second World War when they were on their uppers, when they were hugely in debt to the United States and other countries. But yet they regarded the achievement of free education all the way through someone's educational career as so important that they were prepared to invest money in it. And similarly with the NHS, and the NHS was brought into being alongside free education with the 1946 Act that came into being in 1948. The welfare system is being rolled back in terms of expenditure on benefits, and there is no doubt what is happening in terms of the tax reductions being handed out to the wealthiest in the UK, combined with the tax on the benefits system and the level of benefits being provided to people at the other end of the spectrum, are grossly widening income inequalities, and as Mike Marmot undoubtedly would say, will in due course continue to widen further health inequalities. And some of it is Michael used a beautiful phrase about fairness. and the government's policy being a parody of fairness in his opening remarks, which is beautifully put. One of the things, for example, if you happen to be living in a house on housing benefits, so that you're receiving benefit for your house or for your apartment, and your children are growing up and your children leave home and you have an extra room as a result of that, your benefit will be cut because they have introduced what is called pejoratively the bedroom tax. If you have a spare room, your benefits will be reduced, so you can no longer afford to pay for that housing and you will have to move out of that housing. And that is causing a huge problem, because many of those people are downsizing as their children leave, or maybe the breakup of their family or whatever, and they require, in order to be able to survive on benefits, a one-bedroom accommodation. And that is extraordinarily hard to find. There is very little of it available. So people are really, literally at their wits' end because of this bedroom tax. Similarly, they have placed a limit on the level of housing benefits. So in London in particular, the housing benefit will no longer enable poorer people who, for whatever reason, through illness or unemployment, who have to go onto benefits, to live in London. And they are having to move to the other end of the country to find accommodation that will still fit within the benefit levels. So there's a huge attack right across the realm in terms of welfare state benefits. And it is an attempt to make the worst of pay the price for the failure of our largely unregulated financial systems. And the NHS is picking up the tab, and others are picking up the tab. One of the indices that we use to chart the disintegration of the state is the growth in food banks. Now, I'm not sure if food banks is a concept that transfers across the Atlantic or not, but it does from what people nodding. And we've seen a 700% increase in the level of people using food banks since the last general election. We now have 400 food banks providing 3 days' worth of food to people, hundreds of thousands of people. This is amazing. This is just for a state that never experienced such a thing, and it is really a hark back to the Victorian days. In fact, that's one of my kind of themes. I think that many of the issues that confronted public health practitioners in Victorian times are now about to confront us again. And there are calls for our chief medical officer, for example, for the state to be providing vitamin supplements to every child, because we're seeing a return of rickets. And we're seeing a return of rickets not for any other reason than the way in which our lives are being lived, and the poor nutrition that is available to our children. This is no answer. Mass medication of the population is no answer to what are social problems. Food banks strike a note with me, particularly because I'm Irish, as you might have guessed, and during the famine, one of the things that was set up were soup kitchens. And these are soup kitchens were to distribute food to the poor. And the notion of food banks isn't working in Ireland, because people regard it as what happened in the famine times when soup kitchens were set up, and often set up by religious organisations. And you could only be fed at a soup kitchen if you were prepared to give up your religion and adopt theirs. And those are the times, you know, as Thomas Paine said, these are times that try men's souls. And these indeed are the times. And we are also in the process of dismantling the National Health Service that has served our country extraordinarily well since 1948 and provided services for people most cost effectively and universally. And there is a very rigorous program of privatization of anything in the state. For example, the government decided about 2 months ago to sell the Royal Mail, our postal service, and it has now been sold. It happened enormously rapidly. And in the last year, contracts for health service provision have been put out to private tender to the tune of £5.6 billion. And we're moving very fast, and we're seeing an enormous growth in international healthcare corporations moving in and competing for these contracts. And this will have an enormous effect. The total workforce of the NHS is 1 million people. And that will disintegrate as services become fragmented and subject to tender and go out to the private sector. It's not all like that. Interestingly, we have four separate health services now, very clearly separate services within the United Kingdom, England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. And the Scottish system, on the other hand, on public health grounds, areas, is powering ahead and showing the way in very many ways. And it operates a very strictly national health service on an integrated care system. And they've dramatically reduced their transaction costs and improved their provision. Scotland, in their infinite wisdom, are having a referendum within a year for Scottish independence, which will create really interesting issues as to what the country is called in the future, because it can no longer be the United Kingdom, because the kingdoms that were united will be drawn apart. The best, as Alex Salmond, the leader of the SNP, says, sometimes he thinks that the best advertisement for an independent Scotland is the government in Westminster. So they're on a roll at the present, though the votes have yet to be counted by a long way. So how do we respond to all that and this dismantling of this threat to the welfare state? I think I've illustrated some of the things that are happening in terms of England in particular. Well, I think there are five steps that I would commend. New public health, no, but public health for new times. One is strengthening public health organisations, and that's why I'm an enormous fan and supporter of the World Federation of Public Health Associations, because we need the associations of people who work in public health and who care about public health right across civil society. We need those to be strong in every country in order to argue the case for public health, to provide a bedrock of support for the campaigns that are of necessity have to be run on public health. And we need organisations like the World Federation, which I think plays an invaluable role in enabling those organisations to cooperate together and to have our voice heard internationally. One of the characteristics, I think, is that academic public health is much better organised than service public health. And that is a problem for us, I think, and it's one that we have to address. I think academic public health, certainly within the United Kingdom, has lost its way substantially. I say as a professor in one of the universities and a visiting professor in another of the universities in Bristol, and very often public health has become divorced. Public health research has become divorced from public health practice, and we no longer look at what makes public health initiative, what makes public health leadership, what makes public health programs succeed or fail. Those are not the lessons into which we are devoting our research funds. Primarily and increasingly, it is looking at highly complex epidemiological issues on a mass population scale, and is increasingly being diverted and, I think, distracted into the whole realm of genetic public health, for which I hold out no great hopes. My third, so building more relevant public health research capacity into public health practice and the effects of public health is extraordinarily important. My third one is to re-emphasise the centrality of NCDs, of non-communicable diseases. And I think that's necessary to do, because at times, when tough times happen for public health, there is a tremendous tendency for us to, like a tortoise, retract our head into our shell. And our shell very often is infectious disease and communicable disease control, because we kind of know instinctively, well, at least no one else can do that. If there's only one thing we can do that. But the retreat from non-communicable diseases is wrong and dangerous, and I think we should continue to emphasize the centrality of non-communicable disease prevention in our work. And it requires a cross-sectoral approach, of course, and it requires a health and also all policies, of course. But I think we have to think seriously to ourselves about the public health workforce of the future, because just as the infectious disease and communicable disease model, environmental hazards model, has determined a lot of public health practice, so I think it has determined many of the structures around the public health workforce. And we need to think more widely about that. I remember Don Nutbeam, who was a very good friend of mine in the UK, and he went to Australia for some years, and he was a vice chancellor in the university, or pro-vice chancellor in the University of Sydney, and I visited him during when I was attending the Rugby World Cup in Australia. Unfortunately, England won and Ireland didn't, but never mind. But apart from that, I had a very nice time with Don, and we were discussing how they were developing public health. And he said, you know, when we decided to really take public health seriously in New South Wales, we decided not to invest in more and more public health experts. But we decided what we needed was really to spread public health skills very widely across a whole range of sectors of society which they weren't present. So that when it came to talk to transport planners, or it came to talk to leisure services people, you were not having a discussion between public health people and those groups, but you were hopefully having a discussion in which very many people within civil society had an understanding of public health, an understanding of the principles of public health and where we were trying to go with public health. And that's something I've tried to promote, and with some success in the UK, but I think it's really, really important. My fourth point is that we have to engage with political leadership, and that's always been an interesting one, I think. And I know in my practice, mind you, I grew up and practiced for many years in Northern Ireland during the time of the Troubles in Northern Ireland, and if you could find politics with which to engage, there wouldn't necessarily be terribly constructive politics at that time. And there was a tremendous tendency, because of the divided community, that you didn't talk about politics at all. And you stay very well clear that it was regarded as something that public health people and health people in general really wouldn't dirty their hands with. I think we have to have a new engagement with politics and with politicians, and that stems back to what I was saying about urbanisation. I believe that our urban centres are going to become ever more important, and with some really good examples of good urban health leadership, I think. I've followed with great interest, and I listened to the mayor of Boston speaking yesterday, and I've been following Michael Bloomberg's efforts in New York. And I think there, and part of the responsibility of my WHO collaborating centre is to work with the 108 healthy cities in Europe. And the civic leadership, the one thing that we have learned beyond anything else, that we can't have healthy cities without having a leadership in those cities that's committed to having healthy cities. And we need to find a new way of talking to civic leadership so that at our public health conferences, such as this, or wherever they're held in the world, that we see amongst the audience the civic leaders, the politicians who care about people and about their health. So a new engagement with political leadership, particularly given urbanisation and particularly given the role of mayors. And that's actually five I've covered, Mingisto, I think. Yes. So those are my five. Oh, I tell you, there was one more. Actually, there was one more. And that is reinforce the role of key leadership roles within public health. And I've been thinking about that a lot, because we are now in the situation in England where the three key public health leaders in the country, the Chief Medical Officer, the Director General for Public Health in the Department of Health, and the Chief Executive of Public Health England, not one of them has any public health qualifications, any public health training, or any experience of working in public health. And that's a really sad thing to say for a country where where John Simon was the first Chief Medical Officer of England in 1855, and where we've had a whole range of really superb Chief Medical Officers in the past. And I've followed with interest the debates that have happened around Surgeon Generals in the United States, and one of my key documents I go back to is the testimony given by three former Surgeon Generals, Surgeon General Cook, Richard Carmona, and I've forgotten the name of the third one, before a House of Representatives committee, where they talked about the political interference in their role, particularly Richard Carmona, about the way in which the Bush administration stopped him, told him what to stay, told him what he couldn't stay, told him where he could go and where he couldn't go. And I think that's a disgraceful situation for the administration. It's a disgraceful situation for someone like Richard Carmona to find himself in. And we need to think again, I think, about political leadership. I believe very about public health leadership. I believe very firmly that we need first-class public health people in key leadership roles. But we need to have one thing or the other. We either need to have key posts such as those that are independent of government, but still have a seat at the centre of government that the public can trust to speak on their behalf. We either have that, or we acknowledge what seems, in many cases, in some cases, to become the situation where we have those posts and they're living on the reputation of what's gone in the past, but they are so closely identified and controlled by the political mechanisms of the country that they are nothing but a shadow of the role as it should be performed. So I think we either have to have political people as a political appointee so everyone knows what they are, or we have to re-establish the independence of those key leadership roles. But we need a debate and discussion about that. So those are my five points. And as I said, I don't want a new public health. I just want to do public health under these circumstances and do it to the best that we can possibly do it. Thank you very much.